Thanks very much, Rob. And I also want to thank Bill Campbell, who's been asking me for several years to come and speak here. And the timing never worked out, but he said, well, it's the 50th anniversary. And I thought, well, since I'm born in 1964, too, why not make a real party of it? So thank you to Bill for being persistent with me. Also, Rob suggests that since I occupy the middle part of the Platonic soul, I'm spirited. And in that spirit, I am not going to speak on the future of political science because there's not enough coffee in the world to keep you or I awake. But rather, I just want to talk broadly about sort of where we are, how we've gotten here, and where we might go. I know there's a panel this afternoon on politics, and so I don't necessarily think I have to provide much more specifics. So I'd like to begin my remarks by recalling two commercials that aired at different times over the past 5 years. The first of these aired in 2010. It was produced by the Census Bureau with your tax dollars, if you pay taxes, I assume, in order to encourage Americans to fill out and send in their census forms. It showed a somewhat slovenly man, didn't shave that morning, sitting in his living room, dressed in a bathrobe, the literal virtual couch potato, who speaks directly into the camera holding his census card in order to tell viewers that they should fill out their census in order, he says, to help their neighbors, to help your neighbors. At this point, he gets out of his chair, walks out the front door through his yard, past the white picket fence in the front yard, and points to his neighbors who are just coming out in the morning and say that if you send in your census form, you can help Mr. Griffith next door get better roads for his carpool. And then pointing to the kids further next door, Pete and Jen can have a better school, and then continues walking down the street. Now the street's starting to fill with neighbors streaming into the streets. It's an absolute party taking place. It's like New Orleans. And he continues pointing to all of his neighbors, naming them by name, about all the ways that you're filling in the census form can help a woman who's about to give birth, who's being gurneyed down the street, help her with her health care, a pair of elderly neighbors with their retirement, and so on and so forth. And then he finally says in culmination, fill out and send in your census form in the middle of a crowded street full of partiers so that we can all get our fair share of funding and make your town a better place. The other ad, which was produced in 2012, wasn't a television ad, it was an internet ad, was produced by the Committee to Re-elect the President, President Obama, though it didn't air on television. And you actually you have to look very hard to find even any remnant of it anymore. It was pulled off of the President's website, the Committee to Re-elect the President. And you can't actually, it's very difficult to find the entire thing. You can find little pieces of it. It was called The Life of Julia. Maybe some of you remember this ad. And in a series of slides, it purported to show how government programs had supported a woman named Julia at every point in her life, from preschool funding as a child, to college loans, to assistance for a startup, to her health care, and finally retirement. Now, in contrast to the census commercial, which portrayed a neighborhood street filled with people with whom everyone knew each other's names, The Life of Julia portrayed a woman who appeared to exist entirely or almost entirely without any human ties or relationships whatsoever, except for one really poignant and sort of sad slide. She has a child at some point. We don't know how, where, from whom, but a child appears named Zachary, apparently, who is about to be taken away on a little yellow school bus, and as far as we're told, never reappears. So Julia's a woman without husband, parents, and a child who disappears into the public school system, never to be seen again. And I think we put these two ads together, we see in some ways an interesting relationship. And I would suggest that the first ad is a kind of Potemkin village. You know the phrase Potemkin village, what the Russians would put up when they would bring visitors in. They put up a big facade showing a very thriving community behind, which was a kind of gray and dusty and dank, impoverished village. The first ad is a kind of Potemkin village. It shows a thriving community in which everyone knows each other's names. And as you watch it, if you aren't duped by it, and maybe if you keep The Life of Julia in your mind, you're left wondering the following question. Why in the world would we need government to take care of our neighbors if we knew each other so well? And why is my obligation to my neighbors best fulfilled by filling out a census form? The commercial appeals in a kind of very virtuous way to our cooperative nature and our loyalty to our communities. and it encourages us to fill out the census form on that basis. But it does so in order, as it really tells us, to relieve us of any actual responsibility of taking care of each other, and perhaps more accurately, reflecting a world in which increasingly we don't know our neighbors' names and instead turn to the government for assistance in more and more parts of our lives. What the second commercial shows is what lies behind the Potemkin village. Julia achieves her independence by means of her reliance upon the government. Her life is a story of success because she's been supported at every step by a caretaker state. She has been liberated to be the person she wants to become by virtue of being a beneficiary of the government dime. Of course, we never hear about any taxpayers back there, but that's like her parents and child and husband. Julia is freed from the bonds that are portrayed in the census commercial. Freedom is where there are no ties or bonds to any other human being, only Julia and the government. And the title of this meeting is The Road Ahead, Serfdom or Liberty. I've heard the word liberty now a few times, actually quite a few times, last night in the materials I reviewed, in the packet, and in the 50th anniversary retrospective. But here's the problem, I think here's the problem faced by conservatism today. I think Julia regards and would define her condition as one of liberty. She is free. She is free to become the person that she wants to become, liberated from any ties that might have held her back, whether obligations to take care of aging parents, she doesn't seem to have any, apparently to live and be with her husband, to rely on assistance from her community to help her with the start of her business, or children to help her care, children that she has obligations to and may have obligations to her. Would she call her condition serfdom? Serfdom, and here maybe I'll say a word in favor of serfdom, like Rob Kuhn suggests, serfdom, to be accurate, is an arrangement whereby you owe specific duties to a specific person, in this case, a lord, and in turn, that lord owes you specific duties as well. What the life of Julia portrays is strictly, in a factual sense, the polar opposite of serfdom. It portrays the life of a human being for the first time in human history, apparently, in which this person is free from all specific bonds and obligations to anyone except maybe that child who she gets rid of by putting on the little yellow bus. If you were to ask Julia what she would prefer, serfdom or liberty, surely she would reply liberty. And maybe there's a meeting right now in the San Francisco Society in which they are discussing this very issue. But it's a particular kind of liberty, of course, a liberty unaccompanied by concrete duties and responsibilities to one another, rather abstract relationships increasingly and ever more comprehensively mediated through the state. Because for Julia and the denizen of the modern liberal state, our truest liberty is achieved when it is uniformly and unfailingly provisioned by the state and not on the unreliable, sometimes unpredictable, and often quirky set of relationships and institutions that populate our world. This was in many ways the main point of a recent book by Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne, his book entitled Our Divided Political Heart, where he talks about the division between individualism and community in America and suggests that today liberals are more in favor of community, but he understands community to be the state. And it was a point also summed up in a line that was stated several times during the most recently concluded Democratic National Convention, the government is the only thing we all belong to. This was exactly what early conservative thinkers in early modernity, but also in the American conservative movement, recognized all along was the end game of liberalism. It sought to the greatest possible extent the elimination of all constitutive ties to any mediating or civil institution to be replaced by a direct relationship with the state, offering liberty as the temptation. This would be accomplished not by means of enslaving the population, but by promising that in this liberation consisted the very essence of their freedom. This was the basic insight of Tocqueville's culminating chapters of Democracy in America, those chapters beloved by conservatives but rarely read by them, that the democratic despotism of a mild tutelary state would come about not by force or terror or imposition, but by the willing acquiescence of a citizenry that was isolated and atomized. This was the argument of Bertrand de Jouvenel, who observed in his neglected masterpiece On Power that the rise of the centralized state came about when monarchs, seeking to break the power of local lords, promised liberation to the people in return for their direct fealty, and thus began a long but very familiar tradition of expanding state power in the name of liberation of individuals from mediating ties. His argument was refined in the American context with powerful force by Robert Nisbet in his 1953 book, The Quest for Community, in which Nisbet argued that totalitarianism was not simply or merely the imposition of despotic force upon a recalcitrant people, was never merely that, but desired by populations whose longing for community had been transferred from a range of particular identities and memberships below the level of the state to the state itself. We begin to see, I think, in our time, the predictive power of these insights in the early modern period and in the beginning of the conservative movement, how the new kinder and gentler totalitarianism of our time arises from these trajectories. It promises its citizenry liberty at every turn, and that liberty involves ever greater freedom from the partial institutions of civil society or ones remade in accordance with the aims of the state and of the individual. As Daniel Henninger pointed out last night, the states, once robust institutions or entities, political entities in our political system, have been rendered into almost entirely administrative units for the federal government. Satisfied now largely with that victory, we now see extraordinary efforts underway to break the two institutions that have always been most resistant to totalitarianism, churches or religion and the family. We see an unprecedented effort by the federal government to abridge religious liberty by conscripting religious organizations like the Little Sisters of the Poor or my institution, Notre Dame, to be agents of providing abortifacients, sterilization, and contraception. This is in the name of liberty, of individual liberty. We can expect determined and even ferocious efforts to bend churches to accept gay marriage as the norm, even to the point of forcing them out of the civil realm, as happened in the state of Massachusetts with adoption agencies. And I'm informed by a colleague of mine in the Notre Dame Law School that the words Bob Jones is now being used as a verb. We will Bob Jones Notre Dame. And we see increasing efforts of the government to liberate children from their families. This was represented perhaps most chillingly by another commercial, an MSNBC clip showing Melissa Harris Perry explaining how the greatest obstacle to state education has been the pervasive and deeply problematic notion that kids belong to families and their parents rather than collectively, quote, all of us. And this, I think, undergirds proposals to create public schooling for children now as young as the age of two. This broader social, cultural, and political and economic pedagogy is having enormous success. A recent Pew study on the behavior and beliefs of the millennial generation, these are in many cases our kids or maybe grandkids, 18 to 32 years old, suggests that they are the least connected, they're most individualistic, and therefore the freest generation in American history. In comparison to previous generations at a similar point in life, they are the least likely to be members of a church. They are least likely to affiliate or in any way identify with a political party, though hold on for a second. They are least likely to be married by the age of 32. They have high levels of mistrust for every other person in every institution, and yet they strongly identify as liberals and support President Obama. These are the generation who are best and brightest who, for example, this week occupied the administration building at the Dartmouth University, demanding body and gender self-determination that sex change operations should be covered by campus insurance plans. You can be sure this will be demanded from Obamacare fairly soon. They are a generation that is increasingly formed by a notion of autonomy as the absence of any particular ties or limiting bonds. And so while they highly mistrust most institutions and relationships, they nevertheless view the government as a benign source of support for their autonomy. So as I look at a program title of this meeting, I must admit that it's not obvious to me, perhaps like Rob Koons, what I should favor, the road to liberty or the road to serfdom. Because as thinkers like Nisbet recognized at the very beginning of the conservative movement in America, the rise of individual autonomy and centralized power would grow together. That Leviathan would expand in the name of liberty. He understood that the most fundamental obstacle to the rise and expansion of the state was the little platoons that were praised by Edmund Burke, particular and real ties to private, religious, and civil institution. And he called for a new laissez-faire, a laissez-faire of groups, he called it. He understood that what would prevent the rise of this kind of liberty promised by Leviathan would be something like a robust patchwork of more local institutions and relationships and bonds that would at least nod to this aspect of serfdom, debts and gratitudes that are real, to real people and to real institutions and to each other, grounded in real human relationships, not abstract ones. Now, I'm not proposing that the rallying cry of the Philadelphia Society should become, give me serfdom or give me death. And I, just in case you have any doubts, I'm not pushing the idea that serfdom is going to make us more popular in America today. But I do think that we recognize that conservatives haven't cornered the market in promoting liberty. And if that is our totem, then the progressives will win this debate because, in some senses, they are more perfectly going to offer it than we ever will. What distinguishes conservatism, then, is not that it merely believes in liberty, understood as autonomy, but that it has always understood that liberty is the necessary means, and not an end in itself, to living a human life in families, communities, religious institutions, a whole range of relationships that encourage us, among other things, to learn the arts of self-government. So this panel asks us to consider the road ahead in the realms of economics, culture, and politics. For the central vision of conservatism to survive the coming storm, not even coming, in all these realms, it must provide a better and fuller understanding of liberty. Liberty as self-rule learned and practiced amid robust human relationships and personal bonds of trust and self-sacrifice. Conservatives can't just be against progressivism, because increasingly that is seen by the world as the only form of freedom that's desirable. And it can't just be against government. In some ways, we have to understand that we have to be involved in demand destruction of government by encouraging those more robust forms of ties and relationships. And so in the realm of economics, politics, and culture, I think we must turn creatively to promoting ideas, policies, and ways of life that show that not Julia, but families, communities, churches, and institutions have always been the schoolhouses of Republican self-government. Thank you.
All right.